Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
You know that Michael Pollan guy who's on hold now and is about to join us?
Well, he would know the answer to
he
these things.
He wrote Cooked, Food Rules in Defense of Food, The Omnivore's Dilemma, The Botany of Desire, A Place of My Own Second Nature. And the book that caught my attention of late, though I have read and have some of those other books, is How to Change Your Mind. Michael Pollan, welcome to WGN in Chicago. How are you today?
Thank you, John. Good to be here.
You've just heard maybe the tail end of a conversation we had with somebody pushing the meatless stuff. What do you say about all of that?
I think it's a really interesting new sector of the industry. I have mixed feelings about it, to be honest. On the one hand, anything to get us onto a plant-based diet is a good thing for the environment, for our health. We eat way too much meat for the planet, and it does consume a lot more energy, contrary to what that questioner was saying. And the reason is it takes 10 pounds of corn to grow 1 pound of beef. So everything that goes into growing all that corn is reflected in every hamburger you eat, because that's what we feed the cows. But these are very highly processed foods. And in general, my philosophy is eat real food, eat minimally processed foods. We just had a study that came out this week showing that the more processed the food is, the more likely you are to put on weight and eat too much. And I've believed that for a very long time. These products are high in saturated fats, even though those fats come from, I guess, usually coconut oil rather than beef.
Yeah.
They contain, proteins that haven't been in the human diet before. And I don't know why we can't. I think plants are pretty good the way they are, that we don't have to trick them up to imitate beef to be appealing. But people like their burgers.
Yeah.
And and if this can help the big chains shrink the number of cows they need to use to feed us, I think it'd be a net gain for the environment. Whether it's a gain for our health is another question.
Well, that's funny that you mentioned that, because I was thinking first and foremost about I'm into trying to help the climate not overheat. And the thing I keep hearing again and again is that beef is the animal equivalent of an SUV. So I'm like, okay, that's on the list. I need to be cognizant of that. I had beef last night. I had some beef for lunch today. But, okay, I've got that message. But I should also care about my own personal well-being. And it sure seemed to me like a vegetable burger would be... Well, I won't even finish that sentence. I don't know which would be better for me.
I just had a veggie burger at a bar the other night. It was really good. I mean, they're veggie burgers made from beans and not just soy. I think they're pretty good. They taste nothing like a hamburger. But, they give you all the satisfactions, especially when it's, in a good roll with lettuce and mayo or ketchup and those kind of things.
Okay, well, wait. One last question, then I want to talk to you about your other book. But if it was only me, I'm not concerned about the planet. I just want to eat the healthiest thing for me, the processed
plants. Eat plants.
You're answering a question
I haven't
asked.
We are learning so much about the protective value. Another study out this morning about there's the chemical in cruciferous vegetables. I can't pronounce it.
Cruciferous.
Which is broccoli. Thank you. Broccoli, cabbage, kale, all that whole class. And arugula, believe it or not, is in there. It has a chemical that helps fight tumors. So there's a lot of protective value in plants. And I'm not saying don't eat meat. I eat meat. I'm just saying change the balance.
Yeah.
Make the default vegetables and make meat a special occasion food or a flavoring. I mean, I make stir fries and I throw a little meat in.
You also
for the
eat,
flavor.
You also eat mushrooms, he said.
I do. Mushrooms of all kinds.
So How to Change Your Mind is your latest book, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. The book isn't just out, but it's been on my shelf for a while. I read 130 pages and then put it down. It was a wonderful journey into mushrooms, but we never got in my reading to the part where you actually then did the first-person research. Well, then I picked the book back up and read that stuff too. And this book is just fascinating. And I was taken maybe not on the journey you were taken when you took LSD and smoked the toad and ate the mushrooms, but I vicariously very much appreciated what you were telling me. This is fascinating what you did.
Well, it was. It was an amazing journey as a writer. I was new to psychedelics. I was too afraid to use them when I was young and stayed away. And I actually didn't really discover them till I was in my late 50s. And the reason I did was because I started reading about this very exciting renaissance of research going on, using psychedelics to treat things like depression and addiction, and also using them to explore the mind. They're a very interesting probe of how the mind works and what consciousness is. And so I started interviewing volunteers who were treated with psilocybin. And when I say this, you know, it's not like they take a pill and go off and, you know, walk around the woods. These are guided psychedelic sessions where you are very carefully prepared. You're accompanied by two therapists the whole time.
Yeah.
They sit with you, and then they help you make sense of what happened. And the people who went through that process, which takes about, I don't know, 6 hours or so, emerged transformed in very important ways. People who had cancer diagnoses lost their fear of death. People who were cigarette addicts stopped smoking. Depressives found relief sometimes for the first time in decades.
A stutterer?
Really quite remarkable.
It's not a panacea, but one guy who stuttered had a new
psychoactive experience.
Paul Stamets. And quick stuttering afterwards.
He resolved during the experience to stop stuttering, and he did. There's the kind of resolutions people make under the influence of psychedelics just seem stickier than the ones we make every day and break. And there's an authority to the insights you have on psychedelics that makes them very powerful. I don't think we totally understand how it works yet, but it does seem to kind of reboot the brain and help us break out of destructive patterns of both thought and behavior, which is, you know, what depression is and what addiction is.
So do you see, let's just talk about LSD, but maybe this whole family of things. Do you think we should, as a nation, sort of dip our toe back in that water, not only for therapeutic purposes or curative purposes, but maybe even quasi-recreational purposes?
Yeah, no, it's a complicated issue because simply legalizing them is probably not a good idea. They're too powerful. It's not like cannabis. Things can go wrong. People can have really terrifying experiences, even psychotic breaks in some cases if you're at risk for serious mental illness. But I do think we should continue this research, which is leading toward approval as a medicine, and figure out safe ways for other people who just want to explore their minds or develop spiritually or personally, that they could use them in a safe way with a guide, with adequate preparation, and with screening to make sure that it's right for them, because it's certainly not right for everybody. So those are issues I take up in the book. But, yeah, I do think they have things to offer the rest of us, or most of us. But I think that, it's premature to talk about legalizing them.
So I just want you to walk us briefly through, as you do in the book, what your three experiences were like. I talked about them earlier and described the first experience with the mushrooms, which was quite positive, made me get on board mentally. Then your experience with LSD, which was less so. And then your experience smoking toad venom, which was bizarre. I just want you to tell us a little bit about those. And I want to actually read a little of you as you describe the experience to you and our listeners after this. Michael Pollan is on a phone line. His book, How to Change Your Mind, is about what the science of psychedelics teaches us. He knows about what he speaks because he's taken some of these mushrooms, LSD, and toad venom. So, Michael, you chronicle three trips that you took, more than three, but the three that I'm interested in, you know the ones I'm talking about in the middle of the book.
Yeah. Well, I did. I experimented. I had a guided LSD session, which was not a very high dose session. It was on balance very positive. It ended up being very much about the people in my life who kept appearing to me, my son, my wife, my parents, and even grandparents and ancestors. And it's going to sound really banal, but it was just filled with this recognition that love is the most important thing in the universe and what we should all be focusing on.
Was it like a dream?
You know, it wasn't like a dream in that I knew where I was. It was more like having a daydream, a very vivid daydream.
But that you control.
I could stop it.
Right, that you
could. Yes, I could definitely change the channel in my mind if I wanted to. But I kind of drifted, and these very vivid images would appear to me, and these insights. And, you know, some of them are like insights you would find in a Hallmark card. On the other hand, they really are profound. Love is really important, and it reminded me of that. I then had a more powerful experience on psilocybin, which is the ingredient in magic mushrooms, and this was a much higher dose. And this was kind of wild. At the peak of the experience, I looked out and saw myself, or someone recognizable as myself from my ego, completely dissolve until I was just a burst of little Post-it notes, and then I was a coat of paint on the ground. Yet I was watching this catastrophe from this new perspective that I had never had before, and a perspective who was fine with what was happening, completely reconciled. And when my ego disappeared, I merged into this piece of music that I was listening to, this Bach cello suite. And I've never had an experience of music like this. There was no distance between me and the music. I became the music. I was the instrument.
You felt the strings of the...
I did. It was as if Yo-Yo Ma's bow was running over my skin, and I could feel the puff of sound waves leaving that well of space in the cello. It was not a fun experience. It was sad in a way. It was a very sad piece of music, but it was ecstatic in the sense of I wasn't myself. I was something else.
Stop right there. Now, when you do this, if you did it again with the same substance, do you think your feelings or even visual imagery would be the same, or would it be different every time?
I think every time it's different. One of the really interesting and strange things about these substances is that your reactions are not predictable. They're basically amplifiers of mental stuff going on, and so you bring up different things from your unconscious, and you take in different things from the environment. So I think that, you know, Timothy Leary famously said that set and setting, the internal mindset and external environment shape the psychedelic experience,
right.
and that's definitely true.
And by that, you and maybe he mean that literally the music that you listened to had a profound impact on what the journey was like. Is that correct?
Yes, it does. Music is incredibly powerful on psychedelics. And one of the things that happens is something called synesthesia, where your senses get cross-wired. So you can actually see music or smell it or taste it. And it's just the most astonishing experience how alive it becomes.
Did you learn anything about yourself?
Yeah, I did. You know what I learned? I learned I'm not identical to my ego. And I don't have to listen to that voice in my head that's always telling me what I should do or what's wrong or, you know, feeling guilt or worry about the future. And that there is that's not, it's one character in the mental drama, and there are others. And I got in touch with the fact that, I got a little perspective on my ego. I know when it's up to its tricks and can tell it to shut up.
Well, but what a good thing for all of us to be able to do. Should I take LSD now, too?
Well, I think if the opportunity arose and you could do it in a very safe environment with somebody you trusted guiding you, I would say yes.
Would
Unless
I get addicted?
You are at risk for schizophrenia.
Well, I'd skip that, but I mean, do you worry? Is it addictive, LSD?
No. I mean, two things to keep in mind about psychedelics, the classic psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin, they are non-addictive. And they are non-toxic compared to virtually any other drug that you take, compared to aspirin, compared to Tylenol. So they're very safe for your body. The risks, again, are psychological. If you take them under bad circumstances or you're at risk for schizophrenia, bad things can happen. But if you can find a situation where you can be guided by somebody you trust and somebody experienced, it can be a wonderful opportunity for exploring the mind and figuring out problems in your life.
My producer says we got to wrap it up, and she said, John, don't take LSD. But I just want to read.
Well, not on the air.
On page 249, you were talking about one of these trips. When the music turned more masculine or martial, as it did now, sons and fathers
filled my mental field. I watched a swiftly unfolding biopic of Isaac's life. He's your son to this point. Mm-hmm. His struggles as an exquisitely sensitive boy and how those sensitivities had turned into strengths, making him who he is. And I thought about things I needed to tell him, about the surging pride I felt as he embarked on his adult life and made his way in a new city and career, but also my fervent hope that he not harden himself. I felt something on my eye shades and realized I had wet them with my tears. Later you wrote, it embarrasses me to write these words. They sound so thin, so banal. This is a failure of my language, no doubt. Platitudes that wouldn't seem out of place on Hallmark cards glow with the force of revealed truth. Love is everything. Okay, but what else did you learn? No, you must not have heard me. It's everything. Is a platitude so deeply felt still just a platitude? No, I decided. It's you write like that, and it doesn't make me want to take the drugs, but it makes me glad that you did. I'll say that.
Oh, thank you, John.
I'm out of time, Michael. Come to Chicago and let's have a veggie burger sometime.
Hey, I'm coming on Tuesday. I'm speaking at the Humanities Festival. Come listen.
I knew that, and it just slipped my little to-do list of things to mention here. He'll be at the Humanities Festival on Tuesday. Michael Pollan, the author of How to Change Your Mind. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, John. Great talking to you.
Yeah, likewise.